This law is applicable to not just Hong Kong citizens, but also applicable to basically anyone who steps foot in Hong Kong.
Protests continue in Hong Kong and worldwide. It's Tuesday, July 2nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, split opinions on Trump's DMZ visit, not feeding the masses in India, out of Africa to the top of Everest, a step back from clean energy, cold brew at the altar. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Protesters returned to the streets of Hong Kong early Monday to mark the 22nd anniversary of the city's reunification with China. Thousands encircled the city's government complex in the afternoon as a small group attempted to break into the legislature while police waited inside and fired pepper spray through the gates. Protesters used umbrellas, goggles, masks, and plastic wrap on their limbs to shield their identities from police and to protect themselves from police pepper spray as they attempted to ram the legislature's door open and break windows near the entrance. Elsewhere in the city, a mass march began at 2:30 in the afternoon, taking protesters from Victoria Park to an area near the government headquarters. While the protests coincided with the anniversary of Hong Kong's handover, they were triggered by a controversial legislative bill that would allow for criminal extradition to China. The bill has ignited mass protests for most of the month of June, continuing after Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam said previously she would suspend the bill and apologized. It is set to expire next year with the legislative session. Similar protests were also launched in cities such as New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Toronto, Vancouver, London, Paris, Berlin, Frankfurt, Tokyo, Seoul, Sydney, and Taipei. VOA Asia's Michelle Annalou spoke with one of the organizers of the New York City demonstration. The organizer, who identified himself only as Ken, told her what was happening in Hong Kong deserved worldwide attention.
Right now, the majority of the Hong Kong people is in a position of the extradition law for different reasons. And one of them that, as Americans, we really should care about is this law is applicable to not just Hong Kong citizens, but also applicable to basically anyone who steps foot in Hong Kong, as long as the Chinese government believes that some person has violated the mainland Chinese law. Doesn't matter where the so-called crime is committed, it doesn't have to be proven guilty. As long as whatever the law that the communist Chinese government accuses some person to be committing, as long as the maximum penalty is 7 years or more, then as long as the person lands foot in Hong Kong can be extradited to China for trial. And we also have to understand that we are talking about a country that has a really bad record in human rights, and they do have tortures of prisoners, and we even have gulag for people, you know, labor camps for prisoners as well. So this is definitely a danger to world's human rights and the freedom in general. So I think this is also something that is a global value we all have to protect, not just for the Hong Kong people, but this is this is basically a black and white issue where, you know, if you are against freedom and human rights, I think this is something, you know, everyone in the world should be fighting against.
How long do you think the protests will continue to last? Do you think it will take another couple of weeks, maybe a month? Because I think I remember the Umbrella Revolution took like a few months. So,
right, Umbrella Movement, I think that's the proper term, lasted 79 days. I think this time is very different. That one was about universal suffrage for voting of the Hong Kong chief executive. But this time, we have different type of demands, and we are trying to basically protest the freedom that we don't want to be stripped off. We're not even asking for new rights or new freedom. We just want to protest what we have. And right now, I think the timeline is not governed by the protesters. It's basically governed by the Hong Kong government in terms of whether they can meet the demands of the Hong Kong people. And then we want to have a
independent bureau that investigates the excessive use of force by the Hong Kong policemen. And we also wanted the protesters can be excused from the persecution by the government. This can definitely last a long time if Hong Kong government is unwilling to step down. And this is basically the last defense that Hong Kong people will have. They understand how grave the situation is. So they definitely don't want to lose on this one.
New York City demonstration organizer Ken speaking with VOA Asia's Michelle Anna Liu. The extradition debate has seen the government unwittingly reignite Hong Kong's protest movement and calls for direct election of its leader 5 years after 2014's so-called umbrella movement democracy protests came to an end. Many protesters have pointed to the government's failure to respond to popular demands as a sign that the city's political system is broken. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you log on to voanews.com. Hong Kong police fire tear gas after protesters storm legislature. Stocks in Europe and Asia rally, buoyed by revival of U.S.-China trade talks. Study ties Thailand's turmoil to rural poverty stereotypes. Lightweight plastic bags banned in New Zealand. Japan resumes commercial whaling. Expanded coverage of these stories and more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The latest meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has drawn criticism from a wide range of voices in Washington. Some say it amounted to little more than reality television. Others complained it conferred legitimacy on a brutal dictator. Trump visited the DMZ with South Korean President Moon Jae-in, and although the three leaders did not make any public statement together, they briefly appeared together before Trump and Kim met for private talks. At an earlier military briefing with Moon at a DMZ lookout point, Trump said the demilitarized zone used to be, quote, very, very dangerous, but after our first summit, all the danger went away. Trump has defended his North Korea policy and blasted media that have questioned whether he should meet with Kim, given that the talks with North Korea are stalled. Bonnie Glaser with the Center for Strategic and International Studies said that for Trump, stepping inside North Korea might not signify any change in policy. Trump, she said, quote, delights in doing things no president has done before. But many in South Korea, where the summit was held, view the meeting positively, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
Donald Trump's dramatic meeting at the demilitarized zone with Kim Jong-un. Was it a reality television stunt or a step toward peace? It depends on who you ask.
Oh, come on.
While many in Washington, D.C. are skeptical of the Trump-Kim conversations, here in the capital of South Korea, many support the talks.
I thought it was a well-executed meeting, and I hope it will bring us closer toward Korean unification.
I feel like this meeting could help bring about peace and help advance the inter-Korean relationship.
I think it is very meaningful, and I'm happy with it. It should be repeated in the Korean Peninsula and contribute to peace.
Polls suggest a majority of South Koreans support talks with Kim, though that support is slipping.
I'm suspicious about what it means for a sitting U.S. president to visit North Korea. I'm quite negative about it.
The reason I'm not entirely satisfied is because South Korea is being excluded.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in has prioritized outreach to North Korea. For him, resetting stalled nuclear talks was a major win, says North Korea specialist Kim Dong-yub.
This was not just a photo opportunity.
It was meaningful. The summit lasted more than 50 minutes, and it was announced afterwards that working-level talks would resume.
There are plenty of reasons to be skeptical. Trump is giving Kim the international legitimacy he craves. That despite Kim making no nuclear concessions. But for many in Seoul, that's just what comes with diplomacy.
Both sides are being political to some extent. Our government and experts are being optimistic. On the other hand, there is widespread anti-Trump atmosphere in the United States, so whatever Trump does, they do not like.
The big question is what Trump and Kim do next. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Happening now in Asia, markets in Asia and Europe rallied in response to the results of the highly anticipated weekend meeting between China's Xi Jinping and President Donald Trump. Analysts say the meeting has helped ease tensions and revive trade talks between the world's two biggest economies. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us today on VOA Asia. A recent nutritional survey in India finds the country is still far away from achieving its goal of zero hunger for its populous country of more than 1 billion. The report was jointly produced by the UN World Food Programme and the India's Ministry of Statistics and Programme Implementation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report, the first of its kind, provides an intimate look into the progress being made in improving the nutritional status of India's 1.3 billion people by addressing the country's severe food shortages. While progress is being made toward this goal, World Food Programme spokesman Hervé Verhussel says India is still far away from wiping out hunger in the country.
The report indicates that despite positive trends and patterns in improving food security, malnutrition rates are well below acceptable levels, with large number of people, especially women and children, suffering from vitamin A, iron, and iodine deficiency.
The report indicates stunting has declined by one-fifth in India during the last decade. Nevertheless, it notes 6.4% of children under 5 are both stunted and wasted, and also are underweight. A much larger percentage, 18.1% of children, are both stunted and underweight. These conditions are a result of insufficient nutrient intake and frequent infections. Stunting can cause irreversible physical and mental impairment, and wasting can lead to death in children under 5. The report finds the prevalence of malnutrition in children between 6 months and 5 years has declined, but that of acute malnutrition or wasting has marginally increased. It notes India now suffers from the double burden of undernutrition and overnutrition. In the last decade, it says the prevalence of low body mass index has decreased by more than one-third in both women and men. During the same period, it says overweight and obesity have increased from 13% to 21% among women and from 9% to 19% among men. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, new summits achieved at the top of the world. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, 5 Japanese whaling ships set off Monday to begin the first commercial whale hunt in more than 30 years. Japan's return to commercial whaling has created an international outcry, but some experts say it will mean Japan will stop hunting whales in the Southern Ocean, the Atlantic, and other sensitive areas. You can visit VOA Asia Facebook for more to see and share. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Africa's women mountaineers are reaching new heights. In May, South African businesswoman Sarae Kumalo became the first black African woman to summit Mount Everest. Now, four other South Africans are preparing to become the first all-women African team to climb the world's tallest peak. Maryse de Klerk reports from South Africa.
Oh, I was following this. I got to follow that.
Sean Dysel, Lisa Gehring, Tumi Mbahele, and Alda Waddle are training to become the first team of African women mountain climbers to conquer Mount Everest. They are inspired by South African business executive Sarae Kumalo, who in May became the first black African woman to summit Everest.
What excites me even more is that those coming behind us, or behind me, effectively won't have to struggle as much as I have had. You know, even though we're not born in a place where there are mountains, there's ice and snow, and more so when the ladies go in next year, I think it's going to open up even more doors.
Each team member does their own intensive mental and physical training along with group sessions to prepare for the world's tallest peak.
There's different elements that you need to train for. It is the technical, the equipment that you need to understand. It is the physical that you need to be able to do. And then also the cold. You need to be able to manage the cold. And then lastly is the altitude.
The women have different levels of experience in mountaineering. In 1996, Dysel became the first black South African woman to set foot on Mount Everest. While she wasn't able to summit, she scaled mountains on five continents.
When I first started high altitude climbing, there were so few women in the mountains. If I look around now, especially in the South African climbing community, that number definitely increased. And because of that, we have a greater pool of women to choose from. So why not have an all-female team?
As South African businesswomen, the team sees parallels with running a business in a male-dominated world and climbing the world's tallest mountain. They want their journey next year to Mount Everest to inspire more African women to reach for the top. Maryse de Klerk for VOA News, Waterval-Boven, South Africa.
This news from VOA Asia. Pakistan announced Monday that its main border crossing with Afghanistan will remain open around the clock from next month to facilitate bilateral and transit trade activities. Officials described the move as good news for traditionally strained relations between the two countries. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, as climate change was discussed at the recent G20 summit in Japan, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency recently announced a new rule that rolls back the ambitious Obama-era regulations designed to cut planet warming emissions. The Trump administration says this will result in cleaner air and cheaper energy, but critics say the United States should be cutting emissions more, not less. And some U.S. states are doing just that. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us more.
Protests like this reflect a growing majority of people who view climate change as an immediate and existential threat. But in Washington this week, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency signed a new regulation that rolls back Obama-era measures to cut U.S. emissions of greenhouse gases. The new regulation is called the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, or ACE.
When ACE is fully implemented, we expect to see the U.S. power sector reduce CO2 emissions by as much as 35% below 2005 levels. We also expect ACE to reduce sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and particulate matter emissions.
The International Energy Agency says the U.S. needs to cut its emission levels by as much as 70%. To avoid the potentially catastrophic effects of climate change if the Earth's average temperature rises over 2 degrees Celsius.
We're seeing more frequent and more severe storms, floods. We're seeing more in wildfire. Wildfire season is actually getting longer. It used to be a much shorter season.
That extreme weather has cost the U.S. over $350 billion in the last 10 years, according to the U.S. Office of Management and Budget. Climate expert Josh Sawislak says the problem is only going to get worse.
I don't think the U.S. government is prepared to deal with the disasters that we have now. We certainly are not prepared for the ones that we're going to face in the future because we're playing catch-up each time.
That's why U.S. states like California and New York are passing their own, much stronger environmental laws. In September, California Governor Jerry Brown signed an executive order that commits the state to being carbon neutral by 2045. New York has some unique climate challenges.
For New York City, around 70% of its greenhouse gas emissions come from buildings. This is much higher than other cities and, you know, than the U.S. average. Other cities, it tends to be more evenly divided between buildings and transportation.
The Trump administration, in contrast, has withdrawn from the Paris Climate Accords and called climate change a hoax. A majority of environmentalists say climate change is a scientific fact.
Climate change is not really an issue that we should be debating. It's measurable. We know that the climate is changing.
With disagreement from the White House, more states and businesses are taking steps to battle climate change on their own. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
There are hundreds of thousands of churches in the United States, and although some 4,000 to 5,000 new congregations open their doors in the country each year, just as many close, mainly due to economic reasons. The vacant churches are then remodeled and reused as apartment complexes, bookstores, and museums, or as Natalia Leonova tells us, turned into breweries as was done in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
On the outside, there is nothing unusual about this once Roman Catholic church in downtown Pittsburgh, but inside, it is anything but traditional. Pews are placed around dining tables. The former confessional now houses a bar with hard liquor. And what used to be an altar is now a brewery. 23 years ago, St. John the Baptist Church was desanctified. The once booming local economy began to decline. More and more people left, leaving too few parishioners to allow the church to function.
This church was built in 1902 and came up for sale. And it was, wow, this is a cool building. Let's do something neat. A very European style brew pub could be really, really cool in here.
And so a small brew pub was born. The biggest challenge was to install six large brewing tanks where the altar used to be. Today, Danny Arnold is in charge of the sacred brewing process.
20 barrels, that's, you know, that's the 620 gallons, so that's equivalent to a couple thousand cases of beer. So it's something, you know, it's a lot that we can manufacture in one time. We can actually brew multiple times a day on this, so we can make over, you know, 1,200 gallons in a day.
For Yarnell, brewing beer is a true sacramental ritual.
To me, brewing is almost like a meditation. It's no matter what's going on in my life, what's happening or anything like that, as soon as I pull that slide back and grain starts to mix in with hot water and the process starts and I can't stop it, and I have to go through the entire process, you know, I think about nothing else other than making great beer.
Celestial Gold, Pious Monk Dunkel, Pipe Organ Pale Ale. The unique beer with a heavenly twist has won Church Brew Works many awards at international beer festivals. But it's not just beer that attracts locals and tourists to the brew pub.
When the sun sets over here, when it penetrates those windows, it's gorgeous.
It's unique just because of the atmosphere. I mean, the ceiling alone is, what is that, like 50 feet or something like that? And you can see how they have all the equipment set up there.
However, it did take some time before people accepted the unique interior of the pub.
The first time I came here, I felt drinking beer in a church. I didn't feel comfortable at all. But then when I realized it was desanctified, that I just went along with the flow.
Casey hopes his children will continue the family business by serving the community in this way. However non-traditional it might seem, at least he says they have his blessing. Natalia Leonova, Alexey Osika, VOA News, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find us on the internet. You can find us on the radio. PSU Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University in Thailand carries our program, and we thank everyone who's tuned in today. You can also find us on VOA Asia Facebook, streaming daily. and our website, voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Nelson Lopes, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a great day.